Okay.
I'm not sure whether they'd be filmed, but no film.
Nope, just audio.
Okay.
Well, so I'll start off just by saying that this is an oral history interview of Dr. Stephen Tweedy, a retired geographer from the Department of Geography at Oklahoma State University. Today is October 26, 2021 at 11 o'clock in the morning. So that said, Dr. Tweedy, I guess if you don't mind, just tell me kind of, like I said, I'm just going to start at the beginning. So where and when were you born?
In Walton, New York. In 1938.
Okay. And did you grow up there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just a small town. When I was growing up there, it was a dairy farming area. Mostly small dairy farms.
Okay. So what did your parents do?
My dad had a construction company, the Tweedy Construction Company, which he had taken over from his dad. And they built more commercial buildings. He didn't like to get into private homes because then he had to deal with the homeowners who kept changing ideas.
Oh, yeah. I can understand that. So what was it like growing up in... So which part of... So I'm not familiar with that area.
It's along the Pennsylvania border.
Okay.
Called the Southern Tier. The bigger town near there is Binghamton,
okay,
which is about an hour away. And a smaller town that we thought was a big town was Oneonta,
okay,
where there's a branch of the SUNY system.
And what was it like growing up in that area?
It's very peaceful, okay, remote. We didn't travel much, partly because I got car sick so easily.
Yeah.
So every car trip was a major problem.
So I'm just curious, do you remember what kind of car you had back then?
My dad liked Oldsmobiles.
Okay.
And Oldsmobiles were very swishy, like a boat.
Uh-huh.
And the way he drove, it really did give you that experience of getting car sick.
Yeah, I feel like they're still like that today. But
yes, yes. That's an Oldsmobile for
me. Yeah. So as a child, do you remember who or what inspired you? Just in general? Like, who did you look up to, or whether it was a family member or someone else, or
I don't remember being inspired by anybody particularly. When I was in high school, you know, I liked math and was good at math, and probably thought I could teach it better than the math teacher.
Okay, well that's
One of the trips we did when we were younger. My mother was from Vermont, so we'd go up there for 2 weeks every summer. And that was a big trip.
Okay.
And we would visit them, and we would also rent a cabin on a lake someplace and have that experience.
Oh, I bet that was nice. Especially
but that was about all the traveling I did when I was younger.
Well, so if that's the case, if you didn't travel a whole lot, so what led you to be a geographer?
Well, that's a long story, but I can tell you.
Okay, I'm here.
All right. First off, I went to Cornell for college.
Okay.
And that was about a 2-hour drive. I was just a small town kid, and Cornell had a lot of big city, more experienced travelers and such. But that was as far as I'd been in New York State. And I got my degree in math at Cornell, and then was going to go and teach math. But I was having such a good time in college by that point that I decided to stay and get a master's in math education. And I did that. And then my brother had gone to California. He went to MIT, and then he went to California to work for the Department of Transportation. So after I got my master's, I thought, I've got to do him one better. So I applied for a job in Hawaii. And I got the job at Kamehameha Schools. And that was a real interesting experience. I'd never been anywhere really much. I actually, one of the summer jobs I had was to drive a truck for a guy who took kids from New York City on camping trips coast to coast.
Oh, wow.
And that was in 1958 and then 59 and then 61 and 2. I did that four different times. But that was the first time I really had gone even to Ohio. You know, okay. I remember crossing that Ohio border and thinking, wow, I'm in the West now.
Yeah. And so, well, I would imagine Hawaii was a big change.
Hawaii was a big change. Yeah. And I was so uneducated, let's say, naive about geography at that point. And this would have been in 1960.
Okay.
So Hawaii had just become a state. And I didn't know dip squat about Hawaii. And I remember Michener's book on Hawaii had come out. And so I read that and got a feel for at least the history and the people. I remember going to talk to a professor at Cornell who was from Hawaii and asking him dumb questions like, do they speak English there?
Yeah.
And that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So I got in this school that was basically the Kamehameha School for Boys. You had to have Hawaiian blood to get in there. And it was endowed by the Princess Pauahi Bishop Estate, the Bishop Estate.
Okay.
So it was rolling in money, had an endowment, probably not quite Harvard level, but a lot of money.
Yeah.
But at that time, they didn't believe in paying a lot of money to their faculty. So I didn't get rich from it. But anyway, that was being inserted into a real Hawaiian culture.
Yeah. What was it in Honolulu?
Yeah, it's in Honolulu.
Okay. And so up to that point, you had a master's degree in math education, right?
Right.
And then, up
to that point, I traveled coast to coast in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and visited a whole bunch of national parks and loved it. And then being in Hawaii, that was another travel experience. But then the guy I was rooming in with in Hawaii was interested in a South Pacific trip. And so we figured out where to go, and we flew first off to Japan. We spent about 2 weeks in Japan, and that was, for me, kind of culture shock, because that was so different. And I was not used to Japanese food, even though I had a little bit of that in Hawaii, but I think we almost starved. I almost did.
Just from not being used to the food?
Yeah. It seemed like everything tasted like seaweed or rice, no matter what you got. You know. And this was, you know, they weren't really prosperous at that time. But anyway, from there we flew to Okinawa. We went to Saigon. We went to Hong Kong and went down to Macau because we heard about the gambling in Macau, which was probably not even the level of the local Indian casinos here today. We got there and played two games, and we didn't understand either one of them.
Yeah.
Anyway, we went there and we went into Saigon, and this would have been 61. And the war hadn't started yet. Mm-hmm. But I remember we took a bus trip up to just out of the town. And when we got back, one of the military people who'd been there said, oh, you shouldn't have done that. They just shot up a bus the day before you were out there.
Wow.
So we went there and we went to Cambodia, saw the Angkor Wat, and then we went over to Bangkok, and then we took the train down to Malaysia. And at that point, we were going to go from Singapore. We thought about getting a freighter to Australia, but we didn't have time to do that. So we flew to Darwin, and we started off on a bus to go to Alice Springs and across the outback. And an old guy on the bus talked us out of being on the bus. He said, you could just hitchhike and do this. So we got off very quickly, hitchhiked all day. No cars were coming through at all. We're going to sleep in the railroad station because somebody said there might be a train. And it turned out there were cattle trains, and they weren't regular. And as we were walking down, a guy picked us up and then gave us a ride almost to Alice Springs. It was one of the stops where the bus would make, a place called Tennant Creek. And so we got in early enough, hitchhiked all day, no cars went through. The bus that we were on came in that night. We all stayed in the same hotel. The next morning, we're out early hitchhiking. The bus takes off. The bus is gone. We're still hitchhiking. And we'd had all our meals in this one little place called the Tucker Box. And the guy says, oh, would you like a ride to Alice? I'm going to go down there the next day. But I got to stop and see my mom on the way. So I said, great. Yeah. So we're riding with him. At some point, he goes off through this trace, down through gullies and things, kangaroos hanging off, you know, jumping all over the place to visit his mom, who's out there on one of these stations by herself. And she's talking on the radio with all her friends. So we have lunch with her, and then we take off. We get to Alice Springs, but we don't get there in time to go out and see Ayers Rock because the train's leaving the next morning. And if we don't get that one, then we're stuck for 3 days.
Yeah.
So then we take the train on down to Adelaide and on around and up in Sydney. And then we fly over to New Zealand and we do New Zealand. And then we had the stops in Fiji and Tahiti on the way back. And in Tahiti, we had a chance to lay over for actually a couple of days, and we did that. And then we went back to Honolulu. So that was the grand South Asian trip.
And about how old are you at this point?
Let's see, about 38 to 60.
Oh.
Yeah.
So
58, 58, 20.
Yeah.
22 or
so.
20. Yeah.
Wow. That's an amazing trip. I'd love to go on that trip right now.
So anyway, then we had one more year in Honolulu.
Okay.
And then you kind of get island fever after a while. Right. So, okay. Now we're getting to how I might've gotten into geography.
Okay. Well, it's all making sense to me up to this point, cause I get it. I mean, all the places that you've talked about so far. So.
Okay. So then I had another opportunity to go to Europe with the same guy who took us on the trips through the West. And he had his truck that we used already over there. But this is the point where they were drafting people. And I was getting a draft deferment for being a critical math teacher. And so I had to do that, but I didn't have a job. My sister was a math major at Syracuse, and she told me, well, the math department is looking for TAs. So I said, great. So I got in touch with the math department, and the math department said, oh, sure, okay, you have a TA. And then I used that, I got a draft deferment, went off to Europe for two months, essentially, 8 weeks in the summer. And came back to go to graduate school in math at Syracuse. So I go to enroll, and they look and say, well, you've never applied for admission. I said, well, I thought, you know, the teacher assistantship, you know, that came automatically. They said, no, you've got to fill out this application. You have to take this. It wasn't the GRE, but a Miller's analogy test or some sort of thing. I thought this was really funny because if they don't admit me, they're admitting that their TAs have lower standards than their students.
Yeah.
So I got admitted in the math department. And
was this the degree you were seeking at that point? Would it have been another master's?
It would have been another master's in math itself.
Okay. I got you.
But I found math, that higher math, just incredibly boring. I just disliked it intensely. And so I'm taking these math courses. And I'm driving home from campus one day, and there's a student walking along. And you know, he's just trying to get a ride, and I figure lazy students, let him walk. But this guy, for some reason, I picked him up, and he threw his books in the front seat between us. And he had a book on Asia and Africa and India and Europe. And I said, what do you study to get books like this? He says, oh, this is introductory geography, world geography. And he says it's from Dr. Meinig.
Oh.
So I said, well, you know, maybe I should go. And he says, yeah, you should go and talk to Dr. Meinig. So I went in and I found his office and I asked him about it. And he said, well, yes, you should talk to Dr. James, Preston E. James. Mm-hmm. So I go in and talk to Dr. James. And he starts looking at my transcript and such and says, oh, he says, you already have a master's degree. Yes, I said. He says, okay, we'll put you in the PhD program. So there he was in the PhD program at Syracuse, which was one of the leading places at that time. And I'd never had a geography course ever.
Yeah.
So that's how I got into geography. Wow.
And I'm assuming you, and obviously you completed it at some point. I'm assuming that was at Syracuse.
Yeah.
And so what was it like studying under some of those names that are the well-known geographers that we study today?
The reason I got in was that Syracuse, this was the time of the quantitative revolution.
Okay.
And Syracuse had just lost Peter Gould. Mm-hmm. And he had left in a huff because somebody in the dean's office had changed the grade of a football player that he apparently flunked. And he didn't want to be in an institution like that. So anyway, there we were. They had no quantifier, leading geography department, and they jumped on anybody who had a math background at all. And so that's probably why I got in the first place.
Yeah, that makes sense. Wow. So that's great. Go ahead.
So then the first semester then, I took a reading course from Dr. James. I sat in on a physical geography course, I think. I'm not sure what else I took that semester. But James had arranged it that I could keep my TA in math and still take geography courses.
Okay. So as you went through the program at Syracuse, what was your research focus?
It was actually geography of religion.
Okay.
Because I was always interested in denominational patterns and who settled where and how it was changing and that kind of thing.
All right. So when you graduated from Syracuse, where did you go from there?
I took a job at Eastern Washington State University at the time, Eastern Washington University now.
Okay.
Outside of Spokane, Cheney, Washington. But the direction of my career at Syracuse, you had to take cartography. Mm-hmm. And you had to do pen and ink kind of drafting. And I hated doing that stuff. And this was the time at Harvard where they had the Center for Computer Graphics. And they were developing computer programming. The first program was a thing called SIMAP, S-Y-M-A-P. And you had your punched cards, you'd feed them into the computer. You'd have to have this program in the computer, and it would read your cards, and you would get a map on the printer, and it would come out just like it was printing text on these big long sheets of paper. But it had it was designed so that you could get different grayscales, and if you overprinted things like OXAV, it filled in that little square pretty thoroughly, whereas an O with a dash through the middle, or just an X would give you different. And they figured out this grayscale kind of thing with printer maps. Yeah. And so I thought this could be my escape from pen and ink stuff. And so I took their correspondence course from Harvard and completed that. And then I punched out my deck for doing my kind of map for New York, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, which is where I was looking at denominational patterns. And one spring break, I went out to Harvard and got in touch with them, and they let me run my program there, printed out the maps, and I brought them back to Syracuse and showed them, look what's happening here in the world of computer graphics. And they bought into this idea. Syracuse decided to buy a copy of the SIMAP program. And then I got an assistantship to be the computer graphics guru.
Wow.
And so I introduced computer graphics to Syracuse University.
And was that before you went to Washington?
Yeah. I was still in graduate school.
Okay. Well, there's something to be said for that. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
Yeah. And so I, just to give you the idea, that was computer mapping at the time. I shared an office with a guy who was developing plotter programs. And you think of the stuff that you see in animated motion today. He developed a pen and ink kind of thing where he had a stick figure kicking a football. And he had these different shots and like these flip charts you flip and the pages show you somebody motion. That's what he did. He wrote a program to do that with a printer drawing out these sequences of somebody kicking a football. And he showed that to a seminar, and it just wowed everybody that computers could do this kind of thing.
Well, it is amazing where we are today, but I mean, it took going through those things, you know, to get there.
Yeah. So anyway, I was an early innovator in computer graphics, and that's one of the things I really like to do. And so I went to Eastern Washington, and I had them buy a copy of the CIMAP program and introduced it out there. But one of the problems there, they had a small enough computer that it was really a problem. Mm-hmm. So I was hoping to find a place that had a bigger computer. And after 2 years, I ran into John Rooney. And this is not how I got to Oklahoma State University.
Okay.
I was kind of looking for a job at a bigger place. And I'd interviewed for Temple University. And that interview involved a lunch, and a bunch of their faculty asked me all kinds of questions about research and geography and background and that sort of thing. And after that, I was walking through the lobby of a hotel. The AHE meeting was in Boston. So I'm walking through the lobby, and I run into an old friend who was at Syracuse for a year or so called Dick Nostrand, who's a geographer, just retired from OU and spent his career at OU. And I got talking with him, but he was talking with John Rooney, who he knew. I had never met Rooney before, and Rooney was looking to hire people here. So Rooney says, well, come on up to my room and we'll talk. So I go up to the room with John Rooney and Dick Heacock, who was Rooney's longtime buddy, and the two of them came here really and took over, established the GR department as it became, because it had been dormant, let's say, controlled through geology until that time. So this is the job interview for OSU. I probably shouldn't have all this on tape, should I?
Yeah, we're good. It's all over and done now. So
I go up to their room. Heacock kicks off his shoes, pours himself a bourbon, and lays down on the bed. Rooney goes over to the window because the window overlooks the finish line of the Boston Marathon, which was running. So he's watching that. Heacock's played out. Never asked me a serious question about geography at all, but talked me into changing my flight patterns instead of going back to Spokane, just coming to Stillwater to visit Oklahoma State University, which I'd never heard of.
Yeah, okay.
because I had heard of Oklahoma A&M, and I always wondered what had happened to it, because I used to follow college football scores, and every year the Oklahoma beats the hell out of Oklahoma A&M. And then it disappeared, and I never knew what had happened to it. So there we are. We're going to visit Oklahoma State, and I'm flying in with Keith Heacock. Yeah, Keith Harries, who is on the faculty here. And the plane's coming in, and there's this question of, can it land in Tulsa, or will it divert because of the storm patterns? And somebody says, well, it doesn't make any difference. They're both equally distant from Stillwater. And I still had no idea where Stillwater even was. But we landed and came over, and they treated me real well. And sort of got me back to Tulsa. And I fall off. And then Rooney made me an offer. And I accept that.
Yeah. So your interview experience totally different from what you went through at Temple,
totally
right?
Totally different.
Yeah.
But they had a bigger computer. It took up almost the whole basement of math sciences at the time, all these big clunky machines and tape drives and stuff. And I talked Oklahoma State into buying a copy of the CIMAP program. So I introduced computer mapping here as well.
Okay.
So that's probably my biggest claim to fame.
That's great. Look at what the GIS department is today. Which is where it sounds like that's where it started.
Yeah. So when I came here, I taught all the technical stuff. I did computer mapping. I did quantitative analysis, basically stat courses.
I'm taking that with Dr. Comer right now. So.
Yeah. I think he probably does a far better job of it than I did.
That's rough. But.
And then I had another course. They had a program up at the University of Iowa that Gerald Rushton and I can't think of the other guy's name. But anyway, they put together to teach computer algorithms for solving location problems. And it's like, where do you locate a school or a hospital? Let's say you got two or three of them in a community and you need another one. Where's the best place to put it? So you look at your demand surface, where the kids are, and your supply surface, where the schools are, and the capacity of the schools. And there's a computer program that lets you figure out the location for a new school. You put in the capacity and it sorts it all out. So they called it Camp Algorithm. And it was up at the University of Iowa. And it lasted 6 weeks. I think 6 weeks, 4 or 6 weeks, anyway. So I went up there and went to Camp Algorithm. And then I came back here then and taught a course in location analysis and introduced people to those programs as well. So there were three different computer-related courses that I talked and really enjoyed. The location allocation thing was one that was used a lot by fire stations, fire companies. And I had an exchange at San Diego State. And when I was there, I taught that course out there. And got the chief of the fire department to come in and explain how the fire department used this and the kind of inputs they had to have. And that was a different kind of problem because if you have a fire, the engines have to go out, but somebody has to cover that area where the engines left. So they have to reassign somebody else to cover that spot. And then it got into the time of day. And which, in San Diego, which highways were likely to be jammed in rush hour, and which other routes you might want to take, and which ones were one-way streets, and all this kind of stuff. And they were using that kind of program to design their system. And I found out when I came back here that Stillwater eventually got that kind of a system, too.
Mm-hmm. And what year did you start teaching here at OSU?
I came here in 71.
Okay.
Yeah, fall of 71.
And I'm just curious, I forgot the name. What was the name of your colleague who just retired from OU?
Dick Nostrand.
Yeah. So did he, what was the reason he chose OU over OSU? Or did he have an opportunity to come to OSU?
I don't think he did.
Okay.
Yeah, he was basically a Latin Americanist.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd interviewed at OU too, by the way. The job really didn't fit me very well. And I had a friend from Syracuse, so I thought it fit him well, and a guy named Marvin Baker. And they ended up hiring Marvin down there, and that's where he spent his career. So I've had good friends down there at OU.
So I'm curious, as far as being a geographer here at OSU, where did that take you as far as travels go? Because I know we've talked about some of this in the past.
Well, in terms of professional travels, I had, in 74, I had this exchange for a spring semester in San Diego. And so that was a good experience. Okay. And then I had a sabbatical, get the years correct. I had a sabbatical where I spent a spring at Penn State. I had another exchange with Dale Lightfoot when he was at Old Dominion, and I had another friend at Old Dominion. I thought that'd be kind of nice to be out there for a semester. And so we just exchanged. And my son was going to school in North Carolina at the time, so that was very, very handy. And then I had a sabbatical. We had a thing called the Society for the North American Cultural Survey that was a national group, had a lot of really good people all over the country. Wilbur Zelinsky was very heavy into this. But it was the idea of producing a folk atlas. European countries had folk atlases. Practically every country had one. And it was a combination, really, of folklorists and geographers, but heavily folklorists. And so there were some folklorists who were interested in this project. And one of them was at SUNY Binghamton, and the other one worked for the museum in Cooperstown, New York. And my hometown was basically halfway between these two. So I applied and got a sabbatical to work with the folk museum people. And part of that was to go to Europe and visit these different centers where they were doing the folk atlas work and visiting the folk museums and that sort of thing. So that time, this was a great trip, by the way. You'd love this one. I had a friend. This was in the days where you'd buy a vehicle over there, travel in Europe, and then ship it back.
Oh, that's really cool.
It was a cheap way to get a good vehicle.
Yeah.
And these friends of ours had bought a VW camper, and they used it in the summer. And we talked them into just parking it at the airport so that we could fly over and take this VW camper and spend 2 months traveling around Europe, visiting these folk museums, and camping out, living. So we our kids were about maybe 4 and 6.
Something like that. But that was a great experience.
Yeah, that was great. So, and we traveled into, of course, Amsterdam. We came in there, so we did Netherlands, a little bit of Belgium, Germany, Denmark. Sweden, Norway, it was really Switzerland. And did that for 2 months. And then when we came back, we went and stayed in my hometown where I could visit both Cooperstown and Binghamton and see what those folks were up to. So.
Yeah, that's great. So you mentioned, you have two kids?
Two kids.
Okay, yeah. And how long have you been married?
56 years.
Okay. Yeah. Congratulations on that.
Maybe 57 now.
And did either of your kids follow in your footsteps at all, whether as geographers or in academia?
Well, yes, in a way.
Okay.
One went to Pomona College. My daughter went to Pomona College. My son went to Davidson University in North Carolina. Turned out neither one of those had a geography department. At Pomona one time, I think it's Pomona, but one of them, and it was Pomona, they decided to promote geography by posting maps in the stalls in the restrooms so that you'd be able to look at a map as you did your business.
Yeah.
And the slogan they had is, geography hits the wall. but it turned out that both of them ended up majoring in anthropology, which is about as close to geography as you can get.
Yeah. All right. And what do they do today?
Well, my daughter went on and got a PhD at Harvard in anthropology, but her interest really was in museums, museum work. And at one point, she had a leave to work with the National Park Service on some of their projects. And when she finished her degree, she started working with a company that worked with museums and visitor centers and helped arrange the exhibits and do the text for the different objects displayed and that sort of thing. And she worked for that company out of Pleasantville, New York for a while. And then she met her future husband there, who was working in the New York area. He's an IT guy. The two of them decided, let's go to some interesting place and live. So they decided to go to Edinburgh without a job. And he, being in IT, got a job pretty quickly. And then she joined him. And then she eventually linked up with a company that did museum and visitor center. And the title of her job is interpreter, which means now she's working on her own. She meets with the client, figures out what they think they want to do and what they've got to show. And she helps them figure out the sequence of presentation. And then the other companies that she consults with are the ones that design the cases and the buildings and all that, the space. And then she ends up writing the text that goes with the exhibit.
Okay.
So her title is interpreter.
Wow.
But she's done, it's just kind of job that we all would like, right? She goes to windmill farms. She goes to hydroelectric dams. She goes to historic homes. She goes to castles and estates. She's got one now at the Botanical Garden at St. Andrews, where they're doing a new approach to the Botanical Garden. She's done historic centers in two or three towns in Ireland.
That sounds like an amazing thing.
All over the place. So she does that. And she will unfortunately never come back to this country because she's now established a reputation over there and she'd have to go back to zero here. Plus there's no money for that kind of thing here. So she does that. My son had a musical talent and got interested in violin and then was applying for, he got into theater. That's why he played here in Brighton Beach Memoirs as a high school student. So he followed a visiting professor to Davidson to major in theater, but then he got sort of sidetracked from theater and he started looking for summer jobs. And one of the jobs he applied for and didn't get was with the Daniel Boone Festival because they wanted somebody who could fiddle. Well, he could play violin, but he'd never tried fiddling. So he didn't get the job. He went back to my hometown, worked for my brother, and sort of taught himself to fiddle a bit. And then he went back to Davidson and did his senior thesis in North Carolina fiddle styles. And he visited all the old-time fiddlers and did his thesis on that. And then he applied for a Watson Fellowship, which is one that allows you to follow your passion, but outside of the United States. So he applied to study Celtic fiddling in Scotland and Ireland and Nova Scotia. And so he spent a year after graduation in those places just following fiddling.
Wow, so how is he as a fiddler today?
Well, he was invited to Ocracoke Island to play with a group called Molasses Creek as their fiddler. And he's done that ever since. They've done some tours. They've come out to Stillwater twice. Mm-hmm. But the band itself is aging out after 25 years now. And so they do local stuff in North Carolina. And just had a gig up in Kitty Hawk this last weekend. But that slowed down, and partly, of course, because of the pandemic. They had no bookings for about a year. And then during that same time period, the hurricane wiped out pretty much all of Ocracoke Island, including David's house. So he's been pretty much redoing his house ever since.
Wow. So
we got away from geography.
No, I was going to go back there just now. So if we go back for a minute, so you, when did you retire from OSU?
I think it was 99. I took a partial retirement for a year. So I was out for the fall semester and taught the spring semester.
Okay. And have you, so you haven't, have you taught at all since then?
No.
Okay.
Now, except for Allison's class in history and philosophy.
Sure.
Okay. Once a year.
Okay. And so have you slowed down traveling at all, or do you continue to travel to different places other than obviously the pandemic that's been in the way? But
yeah, we've traveled to Scotland almost every year.
To visit your daughter and
her husband? Yeah, daughter and the family. They have two boys now.
Oh, that's so exciting. Yeah, and I understand you just
over there in March.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and we try to go to North Carolina. We'll be going there sometime in November, December of this year.
Okay. So what do you feel like there was a highlight of your career?
Well, the technical part was certainly an early highlight. And in my operation here at OSU, I gradually phased out of that part. And part of that was because, you know, in something like cultural geography or world geography, you can pretty much do the same thing year after year. In the technical stuff, it was going so fast that you had to throw out about a third to half of what you did the previous year. And I got tired of just trying to keep up with it. Especially, you know, the computer mapping, computer graphics part of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't blame you. So that, when Fincham came, you know, he took over some of that. Comer took over some of it. And I just got out of that. And I ended up just teaching regional courses. I taught the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe for many years. Taught world geography.
Okay.
And that was really what got me into geography. Yeah. That cultural geography stuff was what I was more interested in. And when I came here, you know, I had done stuff with the geography of religion. Mm-hmm. And my paper I'm most proud of was on the television ministry back in the days of Oral Roberts and Jerry Falwell and that group of early TV entrepreneurs in the area of geography and religion. And I published a paper on that. I think I called it Tuning in the Bible Belt or something like that. But so that was my interest when I came here. And at that time, John Rooney was doing geography of sport. And George Carney was doing geography of music. And I got to thinking, you know, as part of their research, they can go to sporting events. They can go to festivals, music festivals. I have to go to church. You know? I thought, yeah. Where did I go wrong here? So I kind of phased out of geography religion.
Okay.
I'm still interested in that, but I think it's much more difficult to follow that. That the historic atlas of religion in the United States, and it's got National Council of Churchill's data, and have beautiful maps, you know, that's still really pretty good stuff. But to keep up with the evangelical movement in American religion is much more hard to document these days.
Yeah. So, excuse me. So what have you done to occupy your time since your retirement?
Well, my wife got interested in a thing called co-housing. There's a movement in this country called small houses or tiny houses, the idea of people downsizing, living more simply, but for older people living in a community as opposed to being stuck in your own house. And pretty soon after we retired, our neighborhood started changing. You know, the people, it was all residential families with small kids. Mostly when we moved there. Okay, now the kids were all gone. A lot of the older people had died or moved on. And this was a time when students started renting homes off campus. So about half the street now became student rentals. And student rentals means low upkeep, parking on the front lawn, noisy parties at night, you know, and you don't know any of these people. And a lot of neighborhoods have gone that way. So the whole co-housing movement was a movement towards living in a community, having your own space, smaller space than you had before, with a common house, we call it, where you can do activities together. And so my wife got onto this, and we started meeting with the people who were building one of these things, first trying to get enough people to finance it, and then get an architect, and then get a builder. And we did that about 10 years ago and got it built. It's on North Husband here, north of the high school.
Okay.
And we have 24 homes. There are 6 residential buildings with 4 homes in each one. And each one of those homes is a different size. 3 of them are 2-bedroom homes, and 1 is just a 1-bedroom home. And they range in size from about 1,200 square feet to, I think, it's 750, the single family one, or single bedroom one. And then out of that, we have this common house, which was the original house on the property, and we remodeled and expanded that. So in there, we have the garage of the original is now a workshop with, you can imagine, you got 24 homes, and they are downsizing. Every one of these has all kinds of tools, and all these tools come together. So you get multiple shovels, hammers, saws, and all this kind of stuff. So it's probably the best equipped workshop you've ever seen. So that we have in the old garage. It has a laundry room there where we can do bigger laundries. But in each individual home, you have a smaller washer dryer system. Then we have a big dining hall there and a really nice kitchen. And so we have common meals every 5 days. And you get somebody who volunteers to cook and has 2 assistants who volunteer to help them cook. And they do the meal. And you sign up ahead of time of whether you want to be there for that meal. And usually it's about, well, if our population is maybe 32 people now, and usually you get at least 25 who are there for the meal. And then another 3 people will sign up to clean up after the meal, so the cooks don't have to do that.
Yeah, that's nice.
So, and we've been eating really wonderfully. Yeah. So that happens in the common house. And then there's a couple of other meeting sitting rooms. And then there are 3 what used to be old bedrooms. 2 of those are now bedroom spaces, so we can put guests up there. Or if you have, like, when your family comes in and you don't have room in your own place, they stay up there.
That's great.
So when my son's group came, Molasses Creek, 5 members, they all stayed up there too. One of the other bedrooms we now have is an exercise room. So we have a treadmill, we have a Nordic track, we have a bicycle, we have weights, big balls, and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So that in the co-housing system, that common house is a very important element. So that takes a lot of the time I've spent since I retired was involved in that.
Yeah.
Right. There's one that's being built now in Tulsa, about 71st Street near the river. That is going to be a good one too.
All right. Well, that's great. Excuse me. So as a geographer, whether it was a personal trip or a professional trip, I guess, do you have a favorite place you've been? I know it's hard. That's probably a hard question, but.
Well, I've always enjoyed Switzerland and Northern Italy. We took a Sierra Club hiking trip in the Dolomites one time. We flew into Rome, my wife and I, and did Rome and Pompeii, and then went to train up through to Genoa, and ended up in the Dolomites.
Okay.
Hiked over to Cortina, came down to Venice. But in Switzerland, I always enjoyed driving through Switzerland.
Is it the mountains? Or?
Yeah, the mountains. I've always been a mountain person. Every summer, I would get out to Colorado, and I've climbed, not climbed, but hiked probably about half of the 14ers out there. Yeah. It's well over 20 of them.
Yeah.
All the ones you could do in a day hike. But plus, OSU had a group that would take trips out there and camp out and do two or three of them on a trip like that. So I've gone with that OSU group twice. I did that too.
Is there anywhere that you haven't been that you would still like to go?
Good question. I haven't done Spain. And I always kind of wanted to go to Cordova and Seville. Yeah. That. I only got into northern Spain once, and that was an interesting trip in itself, because our camping unit with these trucks, it's a 2.5-ton truck, and originally we bought it as a flatbed, and then built a special thing on the back of it that had a rack that was up off the bed, and then it had a wooden frame top with a canvas. So during the day, on a nice day, you just fold the canvas up along the top, and passengers are all laying there on mattresses, just sitting up there, just watching the scenery go by. And at night, you put the top over, you're sleeping in there, soft mattresses. And then we had an awning that you hung out the side and staked out, and you put cots out there. So typically you'd have more women than men. So the men would sleep on the cots outside and the women would sleep undercover inside. So that was the unit there. And so on one of the trips, we were going to go into Spain, and they stopped us at the border. And they stopped us there because there's a law in Spain at the time, going back to the Franco era, where it's illegal to carry passengers in the back of a truck, because that's the way the partisans got around. Oh. And so Franco put a law against that. So the guy at the garden, the border said, oh, no, we can't let you in because you can't carry people in the back of a truck. So I tried the device of saying, the European idea of a camper is a caravan. So it's not a truck, it's a caravan. He refused to let us in. We refused to leave the border. So we got out our cook stove. We cooked lunch there. Frisbees were a new thing at the time, and we had Frisbees along. So the kids start playing, college students now. They're playing Frisbee, and you fire one over towards the guard accidentally, and he picks it up, and he sees if he could throw it, and pretty soon some of the guards are now playing Frisbee with us as well. So after a while, the guy in charge comes over and says, okay, he says, you can go in. He says, you're a caravan. But, he says, if the police catch you, they're going to confiscate your truck. Yeah. So we went into Barcelona, and we spent a day or two. But I was nervous the whole time that they were going to confiscate our truck. And so we didn't go in. Came back over across southern France, continued.
Wow, that makes for a great story.
So that's one of the places I still would like to go.
Okay.
I have never done much of Latin America. Short foray into Mexico, mm-hmm. and that was it pretty much. We've always talked, my wife especially, has talked about going to Costa Rica, which would be kind of nice, but somehow, that sounds awfully iffy.
Yeah.
Being the only maybe safe place in all of Central America. At one point I thought it'd be neat to go to India, but I probably could have done it if I'd applied for a sabbatical or a Fulbright grant to do that as a summer program. But, at that time, I decided to go to Poland instead, and so I did that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. So one of the things I also wanted to talk to you a little bit was about the Tweedy's Travel Scholarship, having been a recipient of that, and having had the benefit myself of being able to use that to go to Europe this past summer, which I truly do greatly appreciate. Thank you. So what started that? I mean, what made you decide to develop that particular scholarship?
Well, I knew other faculty had established fellowships like that or scholarships like that. Rooney had one. Bob Norris had one. I can't remember who else had them. Jerry Croft in more recent years has done one. And I thought, well, this would be kind of a nice thing to do. And I knew a lot of the students here had never really been anywhere. You know, some had never been out of Oklahoma, but most had never been out of the country in those days. I think it was more common in recent years until the pandemic.
Yeah.
So I thought this would be something that I'd try to give a good student an opportunity to just broaden their horizons.
Yeah, no, I think that's great. And I know, like I said, I appreciated it. It made a difference for us being able to go to all the places that we wanted to go and were able to, even despite the pandemic. So,
yeah, the trips that I put together, see, I did two of them. He was a Presbyterian minister who'd done this kind of thing for a number of years. I did two trips with him to Europe. And then a friend and I decided we could do this as a business. And we established the Traveling School of Geography as a business, and bought our own unit, and Pat and I and a friend named Larry and his wife did one trip. And then I bought Larry out and Pat and I did a second trip. And the theme we always had was a comparison of Western and Eastern Europe. So this is back in the 60s now, and mm-hmm. we were going into Eastern Europe countries like Romania and Bulgaria, there were no American tourists. And we would drive into the middle of these cities like Sofia, for instance, or Bucharest, and crowds would gather around our vehicle, and you had to kind of fight your way through them in order to go out and do anything because mm-hmm. we were such a curiosity. And I remember one time I was trying to take a picture of the crowd surrounding our truck. And I was about to take a picture and something came in front of my camera. I looked over and here's this idiot putting his briefcase in front of my camera. And I looked at him like, you tell me, what are you doing? And he flipped his collar and showed me his red star.
Oh.
And this was something the Communist Party did not approve of. And I very quickly decided, yeah, I guess I better not take that picture.
Yeah, wow.
But they watched us very closely. Yeah. In fact, in Romania, on one of the trips, you had trouble finding gas, first off, in those countries in the 60s. And so you could get a map that showed where the gas stations were, which town. And quite often, it would just be a tank and somebody would hand pump it for you. But we stopped at this one in Romania, and it was also like an outhouse kind of thing. And everybody, of course, took advantage of that. And we took off and probably an hour later headed towards Bucharest. We realized Ginny wasn't with us.
Oh, no.
And we had obviously left her at the restroom. Well, we thought, what do we do now? We're halfway to our destination, which was Bucharest. And Ginny was one of the few people who had experienced traveling. So she's probably going to figure it out. So we headed out for Bucharest, and we had a campground book where we could try to figure out where we're going to stay. We didn't know where we're going to go in Bucharest, but we eventually found where the campground was. And so we pull into the campground area, and Jeannie's already there. I mean, these communist officials, they knew where we were going before we knew where we were going. That's how carefully they watched us.
Wow. That's crazy. That's great, though.
But there are many places where you took a picture and you probably shouldn't have. I remember going through Yugoslavia and taking a picture from up on above on a steel mill down there. And after that, this black car followed us for half a day, kind of keeping an eye on what we were doing. And at that point, I very carefully stopped to take pictures of old windmills or stone houses or something that seemed benign.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, makes for great experiences, yeah, though.
Yeah. It was fascinating.
Wow. So just a couple more questions. One is, when the history of the geography department is told in the future, what would you like that history to say about you?
Oh, I guess I was a team player. I never liked a lot of paperwork. And especially I didn't like the whole idea of applying for grants and research funds. Yeah. And fortunately, John Rooney was into that. Dick Heacock was into that. And both of them like to have technical experience along. So I would do computer-related stuff on their projects. And I enjoyed that, and we did good work. Heacock was very much into outdoor recreation, and he did studies on the Illinois River and where the put-in places were and the take-out places and how heavily they were used and how many people. He had a project one summer where the graduate students and some undergraduates would stake out over there and interview people, find out where they came from, where they were going to go on the river and stuff like that. And so I had a way on the computer of analyzing all that data and where they came in, where they took out, how many people and that sort of thing. And Rooney was always into golf research. In fact, when I retired, I should mention this part. When I retired, I had two research opportunities. And one was with John Rooney, and he and I and a former OSU woman golfer named Sarah Colleen formed a company called Longitudes Group with the purpose of analyzing supply and demand of golf courses. And John knew how to get information on where the golfers were because he had a relationship with Golf Digest and their subscriber base. So he had an idea of the demand for golf, and then you could pinpoint all the golf courses and how many holes they had and that kind of thing. So he had the idea of the supply. And he would have clients who would call in and say, I'm thinking of putting in a new golf course in Kansas City and in this general area. What's the potential there? What's the competition? What's the demand? And we analyze that kind of stuff. Would do the technical kind of stuff for that. And then we got from that into other kinds of sports stuff. And that company still is going and got very much into marketing of athletic products. Initially, mostly golf products, but they've expanded out. The last project I worked on had to do with these big exercise machines, like the ones in the Colvin Center, mm-hmm. and who was buying those and what the market was for those. Wow. So that company lasted about 5 years and hit the economic crash in about 2006, I think it was. And so the company was struggling, and the companies we were using as clients were also struggling. The last job I did, in fact, was for one of those exercise machine companies, Precor, I think was the name of the company. And I remember I looked at consumer data, consumer protections and all that kind of stuff. And my report essentially said, it's pretty dismal. I see no optimism at all.
Yeah, wow.
And so that's not the report they want to hear. So John and I sold out our portion of that, and Sarah Kleen's still doing that. My other opportunity was with David Waits, who was a graduate of this department and got a doctorate then from Texas Tech, but he was really much into agriculture and had this idea of a precision agriculture, where you could look at your field, you have the soil types, and all the data about the ground itself, and then you look at the crops you're planting and the treatments you're putting on them, and you measure all that stuff, and then when you harvest, you have yield monitors for corn and soybeans mainly. and he developed this company, some company called Site Specific Analysis, SST, that's out on Country Club Road, west of Stillwater. And he hired a bunch of our geography students to work out there. So I consulted out there on their analysis packages of putting together, you know, what parts of the field are doing well and why, and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And he, that went, it's still, it, it went worldwide. It's now just probably the major company that does that kind of work in the world. But he even expanded into other crops, got into orchard crops like orange groves and apple groves. And at one point we even had a attempt to do something with a banana plantation. And those were more difficult to analyze because with grain, as the harvester goes through, you get a measure about every second. So you get hundreds of data points on that field of grain. For an apple orchard or a orange grove, they have these big bins, and the pickers will pick a bunch of trees and put it all in that bin. So you know how much is in the bin, but you're not exactly sure where the which trees that came from. You can kind of put it in an area. For bananas, it turned out, when they harvest bananas, they have a ski run cable goes up there, and the pickers will take the bunch of banana and hook it on that cable system, and then the cable will take that down to the truck or the loading dock that way. So it's much more difficult to figure that one out.
Okay.
Anyway, I consulted with SST then for about 5 years also, until their system got so sophisticated that they didn't need me anymore.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's part of the reason I took retirement when I did, because I was kind of getting tired of teaching, and this was a great opportunity to do these other things. So I did that for about 5 years after I retired.
Yeah, that makes sense. All right. Well,
And so what other things in the department?
Yeah.
Just being a compatible comrade, which is right back to the start. I think that's what Rooney and Heacock were looking for, is somebody they could live with and enjoy. and could also do a good piece of geography.
Okay. And so, I mean, do you feel like that's what happened? You enjoy, it sounds like, but did you enjoy your time here?
Oh, very much. Good. Very much.
Well, I appreciate that. Is there anything that I haven't covered that you'd like to add or talk about?
Well, there's probably all kinds of things you haven't covered, sure. I'm not sure.
Just anything that you think might be relevant either to your life, to your career, or as a geographer, or anything really.
I have to say, you know, the university has been a good place to be. You know, I think if it fit what I needed, I think what I did was a contribution to the department. And Stillwater has been a good place to raise kids. Unfortunately, it was not a place that my kids decided to end up in. And I envy some of my friends now who at least their kids are in Kansas City or Dallas or even Denver, someplace that's within a day's range.
Right. Yeah, Scotland's a little further away.
So, but you get what you program into your kids. I have another friend here in town whose son is into movie making with Pixar and was involved in Lord of the Rings stuff and was in New Zealand, is in New Zealand, except they've moved that whole part of the production to England now. And he kind of likes New Zealand. But his parents can't visit him because New Zealand has this very tight control. Yeah. And his daughter is in New York City as a makeup expert with theater.
So do you and your wife, you plan on staying here in Stillwater, or do you ever think that you might move closer to your kids?
No, and because the co-housing is such a compatible place here, we have all kinds of friends there. Some of them we knew before, most of them we didn't, but we really enjoy them. And it's a great support system. So sooner or later, one of us is going to be done in, and the other will still have that support system at the co-housing.
That makes sense. Okay. Well, thank you. I appreciate your time. And it's always great talking to you. I really enjoy hearing your stories.
I'm not sure we got into the geography department here so much. I think because the other part of the geography department that has been interesting, there was a building over there when I came called Home Economics East.
Okay. Here at OSU?
At OSU. It's right across from the business building. It's now an empty lot.
Okay.
But it was a building that on the first floor, Home Ec had their quantity cooking, the kind of stuff they do in Taylor's now.
Oh, yeah.
That's where they had, and they had meals over there. That was the first floor. And the second floor was that. But part of the first floor was the child development lab. And so you had the little kids running out there, and they had a fenced-in playground outside the building on the west side. So you had the little kids out there. You had the cooking smells coming up through. And then on the third floor was geography.
Yeah.
And we'd made friends with people at these different levels. And some of the people in cooking, if they made cinnamon buns, they would bring some up. Or cookies, they'd bring some up. Or we'd go down there and have lunch in their dining hall. And that was great. And so in those days, I would bicycle in to work. And my kids would be in the nursery school. So I would put them on the crossbars of the bicycle, and I bicycle them in, and I could see them during the day. And my wife was in early childhood development. And she didn't work most of the time in that lab. But nonetheless, she was connected with that program also. So on weekends, you know, if I came in, I'd bring some of the kids in, one or two of them, and let them play in the playground while I went up to the office and did some stuff. Well, eventually they decided that that building was unsafe because the sewer system under it was so bad that they said it would be too expensive to redo it. So they forced us out of Home Ec East, and we had this great migration. They put us temporarily in Scott Hall, which was an unused dormitory at the time, and we had a whole floor in Scott Hall. But it was just such a totally different environment because you had these long halls with everybody's separate door, whereas in Home Ec East, you just kind of wandered up through and saw everybody almost all the time. So then on Scott Hall, I was not retired at the time. I had my own office. And then I retired, and they, because I still was doing things, they let me share an office with a graduate student. And that was good for a while. And then they needed that office. So at that point, my stuff got moved into a storage janitor's closet. So that was part of my downsizing sequence. You move from Home Ec East, you got rid of a bunch of stuff. You move from your own office to sharing with a grad student, you get rid of more stuff. You go from there to the storage closet, you get rid of more stuff. And then, at the time, Tom Weichel and Dale Lightfoot were redoing this whole floor here in Murray, not Murray Hall.
Right.
And so at that point, I got a whole office again. And then they decided to consolidate the Emeriti office. And so John Rooney moved all his stuff in to the office. And now I guess Dale Lightfoot has access to that office as well.
So they moved here after you retired then to this building.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And Dale and Tom really did a terrific job, I think, of designing this space for geography over here.
Right. So what was it? I mean, what did you, your interaction or day to day with the other individuals of the department, the other faculty members, do you feel like it was you? I mean, it sounds like you made friends who were lifelong friends over time.
Oh yeah,
it was a good fit overall.
Yeah. If we were in the seminar room and had all the rogues gallery of geographers that had been here, I had fond memories with all those folks.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Yeah, part of the bonding experience First off, Ernie would have football games in the backyard, faculty against the graduate students out at his house. And the beer would flow. Yeah. And Rooney was always the captain and the quarterback. And we had a massive front line. We had, I think, three people that well over 200 pounds.
Wow.
And so
it's a good time.
They were good times. And I think there's one of the students, in fact, they found sleeping in the bushes the next morning.
So really good time.
Really good time. Yeah. And then Heacock would have TGIFs.
Yeah.
At his place in town here. And that was halfway between here and my home. So those were good times. Yeah, we did a lot of socializing. And part of that was because we were all about the same age and had small kids about the same age. And you have to do something with all these kids. Right. And that was one way to take the pressure off the wives.
Yeah. All right. Well, I mean, like I said, I appreciate your time. I think that's about all I've got for you, but I'm sure we'll talk again, and I'll always enjoy listening to the stories. So,
well, this has been fun.
Yeah, I appreciate you being willing to do it. So, well, all right, well, that will conclude the interview.